Dublin, fair city, where the girls are so pretty, I first set my eyes on sweet Molly Malone. As she pushed her wheelbarrow through streets broad and narrow, crying cockles and mussels, alive, alive, oh, alive, alive, oh, alive, alive, oh, crying cockles and mussels, alive, alive, oh, alive, alive, oh, alive, alive, oh, crying cockles and mussels, alive, alive, oh.
Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Did you know you could scrounge around for a lot of your dinner from the Bay Area's so-called intertidal zone? From eels to bat rays to seaweed and, of course, to the prize fish like sea bass or salmon, our coastline offers a rich variety of sustenance for the fisherman or woman who is also an intrepid eater. Our guest tonight, that was Kirk Lombard you heard at the beginning there, is author of The Sea Forager's Guide to the Northern California Coast. Part fishing primer and part recipe book, it is also a call for good stewardship of our fragile intertidal zone. Oh, and there's some fish-related haikus woven into the book as well, which maybe we'll get Kirk to read on later on in the hour. So as you listen to tonight's show, please keep in mind that our fall fun drive begins tomorrow morning. It's a particularly special drive for us in that it marks KLW's 75th anniversary in this, the 25th year of City Visions. And if you value shows like ours that explore Bay Area topics in depth and highlight interesting locals like Kirk Lombard, please consider donating early. Donate now at kalw.org. So now back to the sea foraging. We're happy to be joined in studio by Kirk Lombard, author of The Sea Forager's Guide to the Northern California Coast and founder of Sea Forager Tours and Sea Forager Seafood, a sustainable seafood subscription provider. For 7 years, Kirk worked as a fisheries observer for the Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission. Welcome, Kirk Lombard.
Well, thanks for having me.
And wow, what a great way to start this show.
Well, my mother thinks so anyway.
And of course, we invite you, our listeners, to join us. We'll give you the phone number to dial into our conversation in about 20 minutes. That's 415-841-4134. You can email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment at the KLW website, or you can tweet us at cityvisionskalw. Do you fish in the Bay Area? Would you like to eat seafood from our intertidal zones? We want to hear from you. So, Kirk Lombard, did you learn to sing first or to fish first?
Yeah, actually, it was kind of simultaneous. I come from a long line of fishermen and Broadway performers.
So. Really?
Yeah, yeah. My my grandfather was he sang with well, pretty much with everybody, but his career was back in the 20s and 30s, and he was like the male lead for the Marx Brothers on in some of their stage shows. This is not in the movies, but you know, like in 1927, I think it was, Animal Crackers ran on Broadway in New York, and my grandfather was like the tall, handsome guy that had one of those voices.
Yeah,
and they made fun of.
Wow.
And he had a great sense of humor, and he loved those guys, and he had great stories about hanging out and being teased by the Marx Brothers in their prime.
Wow. So back to fishing. What's the difference between a fisher, should we say, person, and a sea forager?
Not much, really. I mean, in its broadest definition, a fisher person, we're going to use the non-specific gender, the ungendered term, because there are a lot of fisherwomen out there. In my mind, foraging is just stuff that you're grabbing with your hands. And unless you're grabbing a catfish in the South by a technique known as okie noodling, that pretty much includes things like seaweeds and clams and mussels. And other crustaceans along the coast. Fishing and foraging is sort of, when I describe what the tours that I give are about, they're about fishing and foraging. But as far as the Sea Forager's Guide, I'm using the broad definition of foraging there to include fishing and harvesting stuff with your hands as well.
So you've been doing this, obviously, then, for a lot of your life. You talked about how singing and fishing kind of run through your bloodline,
yes,
so to speak.
Strangely.
How did you come to write this book?
Wow. Well, I, you know, long ago, I had a blog, and that blog was called The Monkey Face News. And I never really did much by way of promoting that, which, you know, you can go and look up some of these ridiculous videos that I made, which I think should have millions of hits. I have like 278 people saw it, you know. But the Monkey Face News became very popular with sort of the underground folks in the fishing community. It's kind of a funny thing to say. I'm used to saying that when I describe my band of previous decades. But in the fishing world, I just was more interested in writing about the bait and about some of the overlooked, often overlooked in plain sight types of species along the coast. And I just found those things more interesting than writing about how big the salmon I caught was, or how big the white sea bass or whatever. That, you know, that tends to be sort of, in my experience, a lot of what's going on with fishing websites is it's just not that interesting to me anyway. That's probably because I took up the tuba at the age of 43 and played music in the streets and have an underground bent to me. So there's like the avant-garde appeals to me. What can I say? And so things like monkey face eels and plain fin midshipmen and you know, bat rays, which everybody knows what that is. But I have mixed feelings about that species. So we talk all about this stuff. But the reason that I got into this was because I was blogging about it. And then I had a little following on my blog. And then I started doing little videos where I would catch fish out of the sewer drains around San Francisco. And that got me a lot of notoriety. And then at that, right after that, I started working as a fish checker for the Pack States Marine Fisheries Commission. And I would, ride party boats and check on the fish. And there's doubtless several thousand people hearing this right now that I probably interviewed and remember my voice from the Fish and Game Department. Also, there's quite a few fans of the Monkey Face News still out there. And one of them happened to be the publisher at Heyday. And Lindsay Baer, who is an editor at Heyday in Berkeley, she when I stopped blogging, you know, you stop doing things like blogging after you have kids. You know, that's kind of been my experience. I had kids, and I no longer could do things that I used to do for free. So the blog just stopped. And Lindsay, who worked at Heyday, just contacted me out of the blue and said, "Hey, you know, I'd love to have sort of a guide to coastal foraging and fishing that's more like what you were doing with the Monkey Face News than a lot of the stuff that I see out there." And so I went in and I met with Malcolm and I met with Lindsay, and they gave me a big piece of paper and they said, "Draw out your ideas for this book." And I wanted this book to have funny haikus and poems about fishing, and I wanted to dwell on species that often get overlooked. And I wanted to have fun with it. I wanted it to be a fun book. I wanted it to be something that fishermen would enjoy reading, and something that just everybody who likes the coastal resources would be interested in. And I didn't want to just write something that was like a how to kill everything book. Mm. And, you know, there's a few folks have assumed that is what I wrote. But then when they pick it up, invariably I get phone calls and they're just really pleased with it. So I took that into account, you know, which is why I wrote that piece at the beginning.
So tell us a little bit more about this fishing community that you describe in the area. What's it like? Is it something that's kind of in the background there, or are people who fish in the intertidal zone around the coastline here? Are they everyday people that we work with, see out and about, or is there something unique about this group of people?
Yeah, it's a interesting question. There are some, you know, it's almost like I have to be so careful because there's so many little subgroups. Like you have in the Bay Area, you know, you have your striped bass guys, And it's like I mentioned this in the book. It's they're kind of like their behavior becomes kind of like the behavior of migratory birds because they follow the schools so obsessively. I find this really interesting because striped bass is a fish that you can't take commercially in the Bay Area. It's protected. It's only for recreational fishing, which some salmon fishermen, this causes them to scream and tear their hair out because they feel like if anything should be targeted by commercial fisheries, it should be stripers. But the striped bass contingent doesn't feel that way, and they're just so totally obsessed with that animal. It's like a totem spirit. And then you have, the guys that target a species called the pogey. That's a colloquial for the black perch, which is a fish that lives on rubble-strewn shorelines in post-industrial areas. And you see a lot of people with a deep inner-city aesthetic fishing for that species. They call them pogies, but they're really the black perch. Well, or maybe it's a black perch, but it's really a pogey. I'm not sure who's really right. And then you have the largely Asian septuagenarian set of bicycle riders and bus takers who go out to the public piers and they fish along the shoreline. And most of these folks are Cantonese speaking, and they fish for smaller fish. And you see them every day, and they're like subsistence harvesting because they're taking all that stuff home and eating it right out of the bay, which in some cases is problematic, but in some cases is okay as long as they're feeding on a fish that's short-lived and not accumulating a lot of toxins. But so there's three groups right there, and each one of them is like a different tribe, and they don't necessarily share a lot of commonalities other than that they're going out and doing this a lot for something other than money.
And what is that? What else are they in search of besides the fish?
A life. You know, when I used to do that survey that I was talking about for the PAC States Marine Fisheries, there was a question on there about how many days a year do you go fishing? I had to ask all the fishermen that. And there were a surprising number of people who were over 300 on that question. For the most part, those people seemed really healthy. There was one old guy that taught me a lot, actually, just by talking to him, who had been picking mussels off of a jetty in San Francisco. Anyone who really knows San Francisco will know exactly what I'm talking about. But he'd been picking mussels off of this jetty, and a lot of people would never do that because that's inside the bay, and it's probably not a great idea to pick mussels from inside the bay, right, because they don't move around a lot. But this guy said that he had been picking them since they built the frickin' jetty. Okay, so I don't know how long ago that is, but like 40 years at least, right? And you should have seen this old-timer. He was taking like modern dance classes or something at the Fort Mason Center and jumping around, and he was a great guy. He's like and doing well for his age, and it subsisted on mussels every Friday for decades. But there are cases like that. It's like my grandmother smoked a pack of cigarettes for 35 years and lived to the age of 93. I guess maybe that's what's going on there. I don't know.
You talk in the book a lot about how fishing kind of has, sea foraging has flown in and out of your life. Tell us what it's meant for you, how it's accompanied you through high times and low times in your life.
Through high tides and low tides?
Yeah. I didn't want to say it that way.
I've just, like a lot of folks that landed here, I think, in the late 80s, early 90s, in San Francisco. I've just had a lot of different things that I've always done. I've had multiple different careers and activities. But it seems that the thing that has always stayed with me has been this crazy obsession with the coast here. And it was also a crazy obsession when I was growing up in New York as a kid. I used to fish the Hudson River pretty pretty regularly after school, before school. And ironically, I used to fish for eels there. And
why is that ironic?
Well, it's ironic because I had this blog called The Monkey Face News, right? And that was based on a zine. Remember zines?
Mm-hmm. I think they still exist.
I don't think, well, really?
Not quite. Maybe as much.
Not like they did.
Not like they did.
Like in the late 90s, early 2000s. Zines, that was like super cool. But the zine that I did, I just gave it away to my friends. And I printed, I think, a total of 100 of them. And what I did was I learned how to take the skins of the fish that I was catching and to preserve them and turn them into a sort of leather. Really, it was sort of a dry preserve rather than a leather. And then I would bind these books because I had a friend who was a bookmaker. Not a bookie, but an actual bookmaker. He might have been a bookie.
A bookbinder, maybe?
A bookbinder, that's what I'm trying to say. There we go. Yeah. That's the word. That's the word. But anyway, so I learned how to tan this leather. And the best leather was the eels I was catching. And then I got really obsessed with the catching of eels. I started writing all these stories about it. And then I would write them down, take photographs, put it in a zine, put a hard cover on the zine, and then I would bind them in the skins of the fish that I was talking about in the magazine. And then I would hand these out to my friends. And I called it, hey, I got a name for this. It's called the Monkey Face News, an intertidal report, a scurrilous journal of marginal significance. I think that was the subtitle. And that was really labor intensive, you know, to make those things.
I bet.
And then handing them out to my friends. I had a lot of friends. And then a buddy of mine along the way just said, hey, you know, there's this thing called blogging. Why don't you, you know, and the writing in this is so good. It's too bad the world isn't getting to see the writing. There's, you know, like 100 people have seen these books. So I started blogging, and I developed a nice little following, and it was awesome. And I just enjoyed doing that. I like having an audience, and the people that were tuning into the Monkey Face News seemed to like it, and it led to this book. So
let's talk a little bit more about the ins and outs of sea foraging. I wanted to do sort of a lightning round here of different terms that just sort of are curious, funny, and odd sounding, and maybe you can help us understand, because there's a lot, lots of vocabulary here. So, what? First of all, what is an intertidal zone? We keep calling that out. What is an intertidal zone?
Well, it's the area between the highest high tide and lowest low tide.
So it's all basically all around the bay.
No, the whole world. So, but more specifically to where we are, it's the Pacific coast and all coastal waters.
Okay.
Experience high tide and low tide. And that little exposed area that's completely exposed at the lowest low tide of the year, between there and where the highest wave might reach on the highest tide of the year, that is what I consider to be the intertidal zone.
Okay. The creatures that you write about, the animals that you write about, are all can be found in this intertidal zone?
No. Because I wanted to open up the doors, so to speak, for other things. So, you know, I have a salmon chapter. I have a sturgeon chapter. I have rockfish and lingcod. Everything is in there, all of the most commonly sought-after species. And I put my 2 cents worth in on those. Yes, so no.
Got it. Okay, next one. Is it poke polling or pokey polling?
Pokey polling. Well, maybe if what you're doing is you're catching tuna that you will then eat raw, it's poke polling.
Right.
But no, it's poke polling. And what you're doing is you're taking a stick to which has been lashed a wire hanger from your closet and the loop in the end and a little piece of line and a hook to that, and then you take that contraption, put a chunk of squid or your bait of choice on the end of it, and then go down into the intertidal zone and stick it in holes between the rocks, and therein live various species along the coast. You know, people think this is so easy, and then they go out and they don't catch anything, and they call me and they complain as if I failed them somehow. But it's not always so easy. But hey, if you're, you know, into these types of animals, the types of fish that live underneath rocks, then that's the way for you to go.
Okay. You mentioned oki noodling earlier. Well,
yes.
What's that?
Oh, man. Now, you need to go home and do a YouTube on that, my friend, because that is an amazing thing to witness. Oki noodling is the art of, if you want to call it that, of taking your fingers and going into muddy rivers and bayous and backwaters, typically in the southern areas of the United States, although I believe the term comes from Oklahoma, from that oki, the connotation of that word. In any case, oki noodling is where you go down and you stick your fingers into a hole in a mud bank and you wiggle them around, thereby enticing a gigantic catfish to swallow your hands. Then you grab it, you wrestle it to the surface, and take it home and eat it. And this is done in southern areas of the United States.
All right, one more, and then we'll maybe do this a little bit throughout the hour. But I can't help but do the next one: trolling versus mooching.
Oh well, that's very simple. Trolling is when you're pulling your bait or your artificials through the water by the power of your boat, and mooching when you're on a boat is drifting more or less. And when you're on a pier, there's a special type of rig that you very seldom see anymore since the decline of salmon catching on Pacifica Pier. Pacifica Pier used to have people making these really beautiful mooching rigs. It's different than the mooching rig used by boat fishermen. The mooching rig used on a pier has a float and a claw sinker that grabs the bottom, and then you clip the float that has your bait leader attached to it. This is kind of hard to visualize, but I have a picture in the book. You can see it very clearly drawn by my friend and artist extraordinaire Leighton Kelly. We can talk about Leighton a little bit later. But so you clip the float with the leader and the bait on it, and it slides down to the surface of the water. That's a mooching rig. That's for a pier fisherman. Yeah.
All right. Well, we're going to take a pause for a moment and reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco, local public radio, and also on the web at KALW.org. This is Joseph Pache, and tonight we're talking about with Kirk Lombard, author of The Sea Forager's Guide to the Northern California Coast. We invite you, our listeners, to call in with your questions or comments. Do you have stories to share about fishing in the Bay Area? Has Kirk inspired you, perhaps, to start fishing or foraging, sea foraging in the Bay Area? The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment to the KLW website or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. So I wanted to get serious for a moment.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. So you've been doing this all your life. We talk about climate change quite a bit on this show. What have you seen? What have you experienced over the years? And what's your take on how things are going?
Well, it's a very complicated question. And I think that, everybody saw what happened this last year with the domoic acid levels in our waters and how that impacted the commercial crab fishery, which is probably the most important fishery, certainly the most important fishery, I think, in California, because there are so many guys that have permits, people who have permits, and it's the bread and butter, really, of the whole fleet. And when it was so impacted, and I guess the question is, was this just sort of a freak thing? Everybody was talking about this blob out there. Or was this a sign of things to come? And we're just going to have this warm water, which then causes an algae bloom that creates the toxin, more or less, and in filter-feeding fishes and bivalves and, unfortunately, Dungeness crab. So I guess the question is right now whether this is a sign of things to come or whether this is just one of these things that happens in the ocean that we don't need to, like, panic and throw ourselves out of the windows yet about. I don't know which it is. Certainly in last year, we saw some species and continue to see some species that, I hate to have sort of gallows humor about it, but we've had some cool fish showing up. There's been a lot of mackerel the last 2 years. I think that has to do with warmer waters. Last year, there was Pacific Bonito down in Santa Cruz, actually all the way up to Bodega they were getting them, and that's kind of strange in the numbers that they were being caught. There were some bluefin tuna showing up in Monterey Bay last year. I know someone who caught one. Other than – I'm always a little leery of giving too much of a – of sounding the death knell on this subject because – I think we get a lot of that. And right now, all of the any sort of information that I have on that is anecdotal. It's not scientific information. I can tell you these weird fish that I've been seeing. And my
weird in that you wouldn't expect to see them here, not that they look weird.
Well, you wouldn't. That you wouldn't necessarily expect to see them regularly here. I have a buddy named Pete, who sometimes I think he texts me more than my wife does, but he we call him Pissed Off Pete. I hope I can say that, but that's his name. And he's been railing on and on about catching lobsters I don't want to give away where he's getting them, but he's been catching spiny lobsters in our area, which is not completely unheard of, but it is strange. As were all those bonita last year. I mean, not completely unheard. If you look in a book, you would see that probably the bonitos range is in this area naturally, but in those kind of numbers as they were getting them last year, that was a little strange.
So you make a point in your book not to tell people where to go find the fish. Why is that?
Because I don't want to be lynched by fishermen. Because that's kind of the taboo. Like I mentioned some things like pile worms. I do. Actually, there's a couple things like sand crabs, you know, because there's so many millions upon millions of them. But on the whole, I try to keep away from burning spots, as it were. I learned about that when I ran when I did the Monkey Face News as a blog. I just, when you write about this stuff and you talk about it, I think that it's fine as long as you're not like telling people this is where you go and do this. If they can't figure that out on their own, then they weren't interested enough to begin with.
This reminds me of something you start the book off. The preface, in fact, starts off with this dichotomy, asking people who are either fishing or eating fish whether they want to be a consumer versus a citizen. Tell us some more about the difference between those two and why this is important to you.
You know, I just think of a consumer as like the kind of person that just wants to go into a shopping center or something and buy everything and have everything, and a person for whom the ideal of freedom is how much can I buy, you know. That's kind of how I think of a consumer. And I think of a citizen in more of a classical sense of, you know, somebody who's involved and engaged and cares about the place where they live. And I just think that kind of person is valuable to have.
And when it comes to sea foraging, what does it mean then to be a citizen?
Well, I go into great lengths about that in the opening. I just really wanted to kind of slam people with that right at the start, you know, because I really believe that. If you're interested in this stuff and you've gotten to the point where you're interested enough that you're buying this book and then you're interested enough in going out and trying some of this stuff, I really want people to know that it's finite and it's not a supermarket and that you do have an impact. And very often the thing that is even legal is maybe not something that's ethical. So
say more about that.
Okay, let me give what's an example of that would be clamming is a good example of that, right? So we have a pretty abundant population of clams in this area, various different types. One of those types is called the horseneck clam. And, you know, it's really it's good for chowder. It's you can beat them with a tenderizing hammer and turn them into whatever you want them to be, deep fried deliciousness. But to get them, you know, you have to excavate. You have to dig a very deep hole because they're down 3 to 4 feet. And it's just, anyone who knows me right now is just rolling their eyes because this is one of my pet peeves is the way local clammers in our waters, they're not required by law to fill in the hole after they dig out their clams. They're also supposed to only take the clams that they dig out. So in other words, the first 10 clams that you dig out, you're done, regardless of whether that clam was 3 inches or 3 pounds. But you see folks that don't do that, and, it's really a good idea just to gill to those people. And the reason is for filling in the hole, there's various reasons. The water temperature that collects in the pools formed by the divot of the hole is warm, so that anything below it dies. And I'm not just talking about clams. Sometimes the clams will live, but you're killing other things that are living there. And these clams, the horsenecks, they like densely packed mucky mud. And if you dig out all of that and then don't fill in your hole, the hole fills in when the tide advances and it's much looser. And if you just keep doing that over and over again, maybe it'll take 20 years, maybe it'll take 30 years. But finally, eventually, you're going to end up with a really soupy sort of mud flat that doesn't support those clams. Eventually people go, hey, they're still here. When I guilt them about this, they go, hey, you know, those clams are doing fine. Look at that. Look how many I got. I go, well, look at how small those clams that you just got are. And look at how big they were 4 years ago. And you're not filling in your freaking hole. Fill in your hole!
In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're talking with Kirk Lombard, author of The Seafarer's Guide to the Northern California Coast. Again, we invite you, our listeners, to dial in with your questions and comments, 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@klw.org. Post a comment at the KLW website or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. So one more question about that gap between what's legal and what's ethical. Why does that gap exist?
I don't know. I'm not sure. But sometimes sometimes it's just that maybe someone didn't think it through. I don't understand how, for instance, just with that rule, which is, again, my pet peeve, so people who know me are laughing. But with that particular rule, it's enforced, I think, in Washington, either Oregon or Washington. If you don't fill the hole in, it's like a $300 fine. But for some reason, same clam, same ecosystem here, it's not necessary. I don't mean to, I'm not trying to harsh everybody's mellow here. The clam population is doing very well. I just think that it would be doing even better if people didn't treat it like everything's okay. Why not minimize your impact? Well, because it takes a lot of work to fill in. I mean, to dig a 3-foot hole in the mud is a backbreaking experience. And now to fill that hole back in is also equally backbreaking, but there's no reward at the end of it. So that's why no one does it. And I said no one does it. That's not true. A lot of people do it, and some people don't.
I presume you do it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, at this point, I better, right? Because I'm reeling on and on now for like 10 minutes about it.
Well, let's go to a couple more of these interesting terms. What's bonking and bleeding?
Oh, God. Are you trying to like get the PETA activists on me right now? Is that what's going on? Okay, bonking and bleeding is just, For preservation purposes, and because you want to treat your the food that you're pulling out of the sea with respect, you know, you want to bonk it and bleed it quickly and get it on ice so that it's cold and so that the flavor of the fish is as good as it can possibly be. And I think with bonking and bleeding, I think bonking is pretty obvious what that is. And bleeding is just where you cut the gills, so the blood of the fish passes out. There's a Japanese I'm drawing a blank. Ikejime, is that what it's called? Somebody's going to yell at me. But that's where you sort of pith the fish and kill it instantly upon getting it out of the water, and that's supposed to. You know, that's supposed to increase the freshness and greatness of the flesh, and I'm sure that a lot of people do that. I've been on boats where, you know, weekend warriors are standing there with an awl, like, you know, perforating the poor fish's head because they're trying to do the advanced Japanese technique of pithing the skull of the fish, and they don't really know the anatomy well enough to do it. And in that case, it's like, why didn't you just bonk it and then bleed it out and everybody'd be happy? Or bleed it out. Just do that, you know, because that, I think, is at least more ethical than having them languish forever in a bucket. But I will have fish languish if I'm out all day on a boat like I was today. You want to keep your fish alive, and that's kind of what you have to do sometimes if you're out for a long time on a boat.
How about candling your fish?
There was something I wanted to say about bonking and bleeding. Do you mind?
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, so with a monkey face eel, just don't do the bonking, because that's an animal that just doesn't. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what you can do. I think that I've actually eaten. I think they're still alive inside my body because they just don't die. You know, and I find this is strange is that a lot of these sort of species that live intertidally and can exist on, like, 3 inches of water in a ditch for 12 hours, those fish are just really hard to kill. And that's why some of those fish are used for bait, actually, like mudsuckers, for instance. And they're resilient bait because they just wiggle and squirm on a hook forever. So I'm being very popular with a certain set of your listenership, no doubt. But maybe there's more fishermen listening in on this, too. I don't mean to be cavalier about it, but I guess I am being a little bit on some of that, which is just because I'm hardened to years of fishing and catching and stuff. I'm sorry, what was the next?
Candling your fish.
Okay, candling your fish. So a lot of people are concerned about worms and fish. My feeling about worms and fish, it's kind of like, was it Claude Rains in Casablanca when the Gestapo come in and he goes, I'm shocked to discover that there's gambling going on in this premises, right? These are creatures that are wild animals. They live in the ocean and they get parasites. And the main parasite that many species of fish get are nematodes. They get worms. And as long as you're cooking your fish, they are of little consequence, these nematodes, roundworms. And it's almost like it's a taboo to even mention this. Most marine species in the Pacific Ocean have these things. Okay, so the thing that you want to do if you're going to eat raw fish is you might want to consider candling them. Now, some people think this is obsessive and stupid, and some people think, hey, why not? It takes 15 seconds. I take my fillet, I take a flashlight, I put the flashlight under the fillet, and I look for little curlicues that look like watch springs or like a piece of rice or like a thread. And then I just pull it out with a pair of tweezers and I eat the rest of the fish. Don't throw the fish out because it's got a couple of worms in it. I had a friend who was selling some halibut in Half Moon Bay, and he sold this beautiful halibut to someone. And the guy came back the next day with the fillets that he had cut off his halibut and wanted his money back because of worms. So that is insane. If you're so concerned about that, then just you should be eating McFish Switch sandwiches or something, man. Is that a thing? That's a thing, right?
I'm not sure. We don't promote.
I wasn't trying to promote it.
On this
channel.
Sorry. In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're speaking to author and musician, perhaps you'll play for us some more, Kirk Lombard, about his new book, The Sea Forager's Guide to the Northern California Coast. 415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation. You could also email us at cityvisions at KALW.org or tweet us at cityvisions, KALW. Post comment at the KALW website. So you spend a lot of time in your book talking about bait, which is kind of interesting. Is it because bait is just sort of forgotten and not talked about a lot, or what? Why focus so much on bait? Seems kind of, it kind of seems important. You got to pick your bait wisely, right? Is that how
it's important this works? To me. I don't know if it's, you know, important to everyone, but it's important to me. And I just thought the stories on some of those fish, I think people who share my obsession with sort of the fishing cultures and the fishing in San Francisco and surrounding areas, I just thought that they would find that interesting, and hopefully they do. It's only one chapter. I mean, I've got how many chapters in here? What did I do here? What have I written? I'm opening up my table of contents. There's, I think, six or seven chapters. One of them is on bait, which I think is appropriate. But honestly, it would be remiss of me not to mention that as a child growing up and fishing on a small creek in upstate New York, I fished this little river called the Shawangunk as a kid. That was like I would go up there with my dad and with my parents and take off my shoes and fish that creek the entire summer. And I got very good, renowned actually, at the capture of a thing called the Helgramite. And this was a smallmouth bass creek. And it was very strange because I was, of course, obsessed with fishing, right, because that's why you're catching the bait. But I became equally obsessed with helgramites, which are the larval stage of a creature called the Dobson fly. And I became sort of I developed in this creek like this method of seining them with a screen door in the ripples. I put a screen door down, and then I'd turn over rocks. And I could catch a lot of helgramites. And I became really obsessed. Actually, I have no tattoos or distinguishing marks, but I think if I were to get one would be a monkey face seal and one would be a helgramite, because I don't know, I'm just really obsessed with that kind of thing.
So tell us a little bit more about your favorite bait. What would that be?
Well, you know, that all depends on, like, for instance, today I was out fishing for lingcod all day. This was a commercial fishing trip, which I am known to do occasionally. And I was out fishing for lingcod. I was, just so everyone knows, that I'm not trying to make out like I'm the expert on the world of fishing. I fished for 7 hours today. I caught 4 lingcod and lost 2, and there were a lot of little ones. It was a really, anyone who was looking at the ocean today would know what I was up against in a 17-foot boat, so I don't feel too bad. But in any case, the fish that I was using for bait all day was kingfish, which I think in Cantonese is wang fa. I could be wrong, and that could be a terrible pronunciation. I might have just called myself a horse's ass or something in that language, but the term is wang fa. As I understand it, it means yellow flower, and it's an interesting fish because it actually tastes really good. Talk about worms; it has a lot of worms, and so people who come from cultures that are intolerant of worms don't seem to be able to enjoy the kingfish. Or kingfish is a slang term; it's actually the white croaker. In any case, I've just really been appreciating that species because they're easy to catch and they are resilient, and lingcod really love them. And then also, if you skunk, you can go home and you can actually eat your wang fa because they're actually quite good. There's a guy down in Half Moon Bay who sells them off his boat, if anyone's interested. I can't remember the name of the boat or the name of the guy. But you can go down there on the weekend and buy your kingfish. I'm doing some promo for some fishermen down there in Half Moon Bay. There's a lot of guys. For people who are interested, I do seafood deliveries all over the city, but there's also you can go down to Half Moon Bay and buy directly off the boat. A lot of guys down there doing that, making a good living on it.
So you write a little bit or quite a little bit, about the plain thin midshipman.
Yes, I do.
And I know before that we started the show, we talked about you reading a little bit about that particular fish. What drew you to write about that one?
Well, the plainfin midshipman is just a really cool species, and it's cool for a number of reasons. One of them is that it has so here's a fish that shows up locally. They come into San Francisco Bay, and you can find them in muddy areas, in 2 inches of water, under a rock. And then, 6 months earlier, they were living at 3,000 feet, way offshore. And that disparity of depths in their life sort of conveys to me that there must be an incredible epic journey, right? So they come from, so like a salmon has an epic journey. But what about the epic journey of a plainfin midshipman, a creature that lives at these tremendous depths offshore and then comes all the way into a tidal mudflat to lay its eggs in 2 inches of water, or sometimes in no water? I mean, they go in there at high tide, and then on a minus tide, you can't, those rocks are completely exposed. And then on top of that, the plainfin midshipman has photopores on its side that light up when it's been eating a certain type of algae, so it lights up with blue spots. And then to cap it off, as if that weren't enough, it has the ability to sing. And its voice, if you ever heard those, can I even do, I can't really do that. That's my best Tuvan throat singing. Oh, yeah, got it there. That's kind of what a plainfin midshipman sounds like, except it's more staccato. So you got a singing fish that lives at this insane range of depths that also lights up when it's been eating a certain type of algae, these light blue spots. And then on top of it, it also has, I think, although I don't think this has been confirmed by science, I've been jabbed by their opercular spines, and I found that it was kind of like a rockfish, like there must be some toxin in the mucus of this species. So all of these things made me think that this is an exceptional animal, and it deserved, rather than just being talked about as something that fishermen stick a hook in and throw out in the water to catch a bigger fish, that it should be mentioned.
So what are you going to read us?
Oh, would you like me to read something?
I would.
Okay. I'm going to read you a little piece. And there's this great artwork by the artist in this book, Leighton Kelly. I would love to talk about him, but I think we're running out of time. I will read you this little piece. It's called The Death Song of the Toadfishes. And it is, of course, the plainfin midshipman is in the toadfish family, so... that's what this is about. And there might be a few things here that I didn't explain, but hopefully you'll get the gist of the thing. The Death Song of the Toadfishes. I'm not sure why, but leopard sharks really like midshipmen. And for a halibut or anything else to take your offering of one is going to have to get in line behind every leopard shark inhabiting the spot where you're fishing. My last time out on my kayak, I caught about a half a dozen sharks on a single plain fin. He couldn't seem to stay in the water for 5 minutes before a leopard shark would slam him and start dragging me into the shipping lanes, and they seemed to like him better dead and chewed than alive and squirming. As anyone who kayak fishes can confirm, however fun leopard sharks are to fight, they are a royal pain in the arse to unhook. Especially the big ones, on a windy day, with a strong outgoing tide, on a 10-foot sit-on-top kayak. But the strange thing was, everywhere I went that day, it was the same. Along rocky shoreline, over under the piers, out in the open water, leopard shark after leopard shark after leopard shark. It was as if they were following me. They were. After fishing for 2 hours with that one midshipman, I pulled in my live bait bucket, which usually trails behind me on a rope as I drift, and decided to swap out my wildly popular shredded baitfish for a new one. I placed the bucket on the kayak, cleaned the grim remnants of the first midshipman off my hook, and suddenly noticed that the boat was buzzing. The midshipmen, their nests destroyed, because you have to turn the rock over in order to catch them. Their nests destroyed, their eggs uprooted, their lives about to be forfeit to the uncaring jaws of a sluggish bottom dweller, were singing. I held the bucket to my ear. What was this song? How often had they sung it? In the depths of the sea? In the polluted sluices of Stege Marsh? In the yuppie flats of Tiburon? Was it their national anthem? Their rembetika? Their blues? After a few moments, I realized what I was listening to. It was the death song of the toadfishes. I sat there for a while, staring out at the container ships, listening to this melancholy, monotonal death song, feeling, I suppose, not unlike the Grinch staring down on Whoville before his Yuletide transformation. After a few gut-wrenching moments, my calloused fisherman's heart swollen to thrice its actual size, I paddled to shore and dumped the remaining midshipmen back into the turbid waters from whence they came. I have little doubt that a sizable school of leopard sharks had been following my kayak all day. It was not a bait bucket, but a leopard shark dinner bell that I'd been dragging behind me. I guess every fisherman has his weakness, his figurative kryptonite. But how can one justify destroying their nests and skewering their remarkable little bodies just to waste them on leopard sharks? If you find that they're great for halibut or lings or striper or sea bass, maybe. But leopard sharks? Thanks. I'll stick to squid. There's a footnote here, but I'm not going to read it. Honestly, I think the problem here is that I know too much about these little buggers to use them for bait. And now, with any luck, so do you.
And would you like to read the haiku that follows?
I hope it's the right number of syllables. I always wonder about this. I hope the editor caught this. Lindsay, I hope you caught this. Okay, haiku number 214. I numbered them all. That doesn't mean there were 214 in this book, by the way, if you hate haikus. I just put them in everywhere. There's actually a term for the humorous haiku, and I can't remember what it is. Somebody will call and tell you that. Plainfin midshipman, most talented of fishes, why not leave them be?
And that is our guest, Kirk Lombard, reading from his book, The Seafarer's Guide to the Northern California Coast. We have a tweet from Peter, who asks, should I never buy farmed fish?
Hold on one second.
You're scribbling a note to me.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. We could talk about the artist.
Yes, but
I first got to answer Peter's tweet.
Oh, yeah, Peter. Unfortunately, there's a lot of misinformation about farmed fish. I am not a big advocate of farmed fish, but there is one exception, and it is a local exception. And I'm not going to pretend that I don't have my own interest in it, because one of my business partners with my seafood company is Kenny Beloff at 2xC, the owner of 2xC, the owner of Fish Restaurant in Sausalito. And Kenny is part owner of McFarland Springs Rainbow Trout. Now, the big problem that you have with farmed fish is that there are two things. There's waste. What do we do with the waste? Well, actually, there's not more than two things. There's six things. But the main thing is, what do you do with the waste? Another thing is, what are those fish eating? So is it a good idea to go out into the ocean and harvest in gigantic numbers herring, menhaden, anchovies, and sardines, and turn them into pellets to go and feed a farmed fish? Is that a good idea? I think within the industry, there's people who will argue this, and they will say that things have gotten a lot better. But I just think, personally, I think it's just a way better idea to eat those fish. It's a better idea to eat the sardines. Why are we not doing more of that? Why aren't we eating more herring? And it's cultural, and I don't mean to vibe people or whatever. But people want to look for the sustainable solution in things, and one of the things you can do is you can eat small schooling fishes a little more regularly. You don't have to replace your halibut steaks and your tuna, but just every now and then, if you could, eat some sardines or anchovies. There's a great fishing boat out of Half Moon Bay that sells these small fish. It's called the Sardella, and it's run by a guy who goes by the name of Pete the Greek. And Pete is catching these fish in an amazing way. And I know I'm running out of time here. So
we have a call to get to, actually.
Okay, let's see. I hope Peter gets it. Go with McFarland Springs Rainbow Trout and be very dubious about all of the things that people say about how sustainable farm fish is, because by and large, it's not. McFarland Springs Rainbow Trout is different. They developed a feed pellet based on algae, and everything goes into a all of the waste is fed out upon a field where horses graze. I mean, it's ridiculous. You know the name of each trout, you know.
All right. Let's get George from San Francisco on the line. Welcome to the program, George.
Thanks. Brother Monkeyface, there is a question about when seasonal figuring must apply to fishing in the intertidal zone. So you have to ask when is the best time. And then there's the other question that's got to go with that, which is, where to go and where not to go. Can you give us in 30 or 60 seconds a sense about what to avoid and where not to fish?
Oh, man.
Thanks so much, George, for your call.
Okay, so you don't want to fish in deep inner city areas where there isn't a lot of flow, or you don't want to catch stuff or harvest stuff inside of coastal harbors where there's a lot of boats, a lot of boat traffic. And as far as when, man, you know, as much as I want to help you with that, it depends on what you're talking about. Like the when you're going to catch a monkey face seal is different than the when you're going to catch a striped bass. And especially also in terms of what months of the year and what seasons of the year. So it's a really...
Is it like a fish wheel?
Awesome!
Or something? Somewhere?
Well, what I want to tell George, just buy my book, man! Because you'll get more detail than I can possibly give you, because I'm running out of time. I have 4 minutes.
And you're right. You have less, actually. But the illustrations are amazing. Say 30 seconds about the artist.
The artist is Leighton Kelly. And Leighton is, I like to call Leighton, the Leonardo da Vinci of Oakland. And I met him long ago when we were both in different bands. He was performing on stage and I was playing tuba in a band. And but Leighton's artwork in this is incredible. And the story, if I may, very quickly, if you look at my book, aesthetically speaking, now this is a fishing book. It's not a tome of marine biology. But I wanted this book to look like the book Marine Between Pacific Tides by Doc Ricketts. Because I had that copy. I've had it my whole life. And I just love the first edition of Between Pacific Tides. I love the green cover, and I love the aesthetic of the drawings. And in talking to Leighton, because I got Leighton on board with this project years ago, and I told him, hey, as a governing principle, I want the book, even though it's not a marine biology book, it is essentially a foraging book with little bits of pseudoscience in there to keep the fish heads happy. To describe
it. 20 seconds.
Okay. In order to describe it, I told Leighton, I want it to look like Between Pacific Tides. Do you know that book? And Leighton, being an artist in Oakland, I didn't think he would know it. And he said, I know it. It's sitting right here on my desk. Of course, you want it to look like this? And I said, yes. And I said, how is it that you happen to have a copy of that book, Leighton? And he said, my grandfather did all of the illustrations for Between Pacific Tides. His name was Richie Lovejoy. And so at that point, I knew that it was meant to be.
Wow. Wow, what a great story. If you are enthralled, as I am, by Kirk Lombard, our guest this evening, author of The Sea Farager's Guide to the Northern California Coast, where can people meet you on your book tour? How do they find out?
Oh, well, just go to our website, and you'll see on our website there's...
What's the website?
Seaforager.com. And you can just go there, and you'll see that the screen, the homepage is split into a picture of a book and a picture of seafood that you can get from us. Click on the picture of the book, and you will see all of our tour dates up to the coast to Portland, Oregon, occurring at the end of September and into October.
So thanks, Kirk, for joining me. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at klw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. Help KLW's fall membership drive get started now. Go to klw.org on this 75th anniversary of the station and click on the Donate Now button. Join my co-host Ethan Elkind next Monday as we discuss the future with driverless cars. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.
KALW is a media.
I'm Helen.